Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I'm a resident. This is episode 231 of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. This is the USMLE Military Podcast. This is part two. There's a part one. I know it's one of those episodes just above 200. Again, very high yield episode to listen to. I promise you, if you're taking the exam, it's something you definitely want to listen to. Again, I'm literally not making this up. You can go ahead and look at the content outline for the exam and the very clearly outline that you'll be testing these kinds of concepts on the exams going forward. Okay, so this is the USMLE and the military. This is part two. And in this one, I'm going to be focusing on, again, a different series of problems that tends to happen in people that are coming back from, you know, being deployed or something like that. The last time I focused on the psychological stuff, the psychiatric stuff, the drug abuse stuff. In this case, I'm going to focus more on, like, you know, like infectious related things, right? So let's go ahead and jump right into it, right? So essentially, what kinds of vaccines are kind of required before you get deployed as a military service member? Well, you know, you'll need the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, right? So the MMR. You'll need the tetanus, diphtheria, and pertussis. You'll need the influenza vaccine. You'll need polio. You'll need the hep A vaccine. You'll need the typhoid vaccine. You'll need the varicella vaccine. And the thing is, if a place has particularly, you know, high incidences of some other things like yellow fever, smallpox, anthrax, you should also, you know, go ahead and get those vaccines. If you're a medic, so if you're like a physician, right, like a Navy physician, an Army physician or whatever, you need the hep B vaccine, right? And then in general, right, like these people that go, again, get deployed, you know, they get like DEET. I think they kind of like put it on their skin or something like that. And many times their field uniforms tend to be treated with a permethrin to kind of, again, protect them against many of these zoonotic crap, right? And then remember, right, if they give you a question about like a service member that, you know, had a lot of sex overseas with multiple partners, and then this patient has been, you know, feeling like crap and having like jaundice and hepatomegaly, you know, you want to think about Hep B under those circumstances. And if you see like an outbreak style situation, right, again, like in a military barracks or a military camp or something like that, right, where you see a lot of people with nuchal rigidity and all that stuff, you want to think about Neisseria meningitis, right? And remember, your drug of choice is ceftriaxone. And then if you're a close contact, you get rifampin, right? Although remember, you can use Cipro and ceftriaxone as a close contact prophylaxis as well. But, you know, in general, if you're pregnant, you can't really use any of those things other than ceftriaxone, right? And I mean, just some common sense things to adopt as a military service member. Again, they can ask this as a preventive medicine question, right? You don't want to be petting or feeding animals, right? When you're deployed overseas, that's not very prudent, right? You don't want to, again, directly contact like animals or animal products. You don't want to adopt like all these like stray animals as your pets. You know, like common sense things you probably do in the US, right? You know, just kind of extend that common sense to when you leave the country, right? And again, remember, there is in fact a vaccine available for rabies, right? So just something to keep in mind. Okay, now what if they give you a question about a patient? They tell you that this patient just returned from deployment in Egypt, right? Or some Middle Eastern country. And when this patient came back, they tell you that, oh, this person has been having like hepatosplenomegaly, has like portal hypertension, or they may tell you something about having like hematuria. If you see that, I would really hope that you're thinking about schistosomiasis, right? So schistosomiasis, you know, it's pretty common, right? Especially like in Egypt, right? Like in the Nile and stuff, right? So remember, there are two types of schistosomiasis you may see on a test, right? So you may see like schistosoma hematobium. That's probably the more common one, right? That's the one that has that egg with like a terminal spine, right? And it tends to cause like bladder cancer, right? Like if you see like a person from Egypt with bladder cancer, that's going to be schistosoma. And the thing is, remember, most bladder cancers tend to be transitional cell carcinoma. But schistosoma hematobium is kind of special. It actually causes a squamous cell cancer of the bladder. That is very unusual. So you can almost predict that there's some kind of metaplasia that happens in the bladder epithelium, right? And then that metaplasia leads to dysplasia, and then that dysplasia leads to cancer, right? And the thing is, people can also get like pulmonary hypertension from schistosoma hematobium, right? And then schistosoma mansoni is the one that has the lateral spine, right? And it tends to torch the liver for the most part, you know, causes like hepatosplenomegaly and all that badness. And again, the method of transmission is through water, right? So if they describe a person that did like some marine missions or, you know, was an underwater diver in the military or something like that, and then came back and has all these symptoms, you know what you're going after. And really, the way you treat this is with a praziquantel. You treat it with praziquantel, right? And again, actually, the most common infection that people tend to get during deployment is actually diarrhea, right? And that diarrhea is usually from the norovirus, right? So from like Norwalk virus, right? That's something high yield you want to keep in mind for exams. And then, what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that, oh, this patient, went to, you know, like some African country, like on a peacekeeping mission. And then the patient came back not too long ago, maybe this was while deployed. They tell you that, oh, this patient had flu-like symptoms. And then over time, this patient started like bleeding from everywhere, had like petechiae on the skin, had like this maculopapular rash, was having hemoptysis, having like pooping blood and all that badness. If you see that, I would really hope you're thinking about the Ebola virus, right? In fact, they may tell you that this patient had like contact with animals, right? Animals like monkeys, right? Or dogs, or even dead bodies, right? During the course of your deployment or whatever. And then they came back and then they have all this badness. You want to think about the Ebola virus, right? Another one you may see is the Marburg, like Marburg virus, right? And again, remember, the way this virus is spread is, you know, like through like direct contact with like bodily fluids, or, you know, if you have like aerosolized droplets, that can actually transmit the Ebola. And there's no real treatment. I mean, you can do supportive care, hope for the best, but most people that get this stuff die, right? And again, you want to be careful. You don't want to handle wild animals while you're deployed. In fact, if you see that buzzword wild animals in a question, think about Ebola virus, right? Think about Ebola virus. So again, they'll have like flu-like, like when you get exposed, right? So again, it can be a person, it's not going to be a person 3 years after they came back from being deployed. No, it'll be a person that was, you know, came back from deployment like 10 days ago, right? And then, you know, the person starts feeling like crap, like, you know, like having like diarrhea, vomiting and all that stuff, high fevers, myalgias. And then over time, the person will just start bleeding from everywhere. And basically, they die because essentially like their capillaries become like extremely leaky, right? They go into shock, like a hemorrhagic kind of shock. It's like a terrible, terrible, terrible way to die, right? So it's one of those big things you want to keep at the back of your mind. Or they can even give you a question about a person, like a person that was working at a military hospital where they were taking care of people with Ebola or something. And then the person could potentially get Ebola that way, right? So again, those are just all high yield things to keep at the back of your mind. Another hemorrhagic style, whatever thingy, right? Like you want to think about like hantavirus, right? So if they tell you that a person, again, came back from deployment, maybe this person lived in like a place with you know, like a lot of mice, especially like the deer mouse, right? And you know, if you see any of those things, and then they tell you that, oh, this person starts having, or maybe this person worked in a barn and this barn was filled with a lot of rodents, right? Like if you put the word barn, you really want to think about the hantavirus, right? And it can even be someone that is in one of these like military bases, like in the New Mexico, Arizona, Colorado, Utah area of the country, right? Those things are associated with the hantavirus, right? These people have like, you know, like a flu, like some flu-like symptoms. And again, it's pretty bad. I mean, like it can cause like a hemorrhagic fever, right? Or it can cause like a pulmonary thing. In fact, there's this thing called hemorrhagic fever or renal syndrome. There's this thing called hantavirus pulmonary syndrome. And again, these people, they can be people that were deployed like in Korea, right? That's definitely a place where the US military is deployed. Or you can see a person that's just come back from Russia or from China, right? Again, don't forget, like again, they'll have like these super high fevers, they'll have like flu-like symptoms, and then they'll have like these bilateral pulmonary edema, right? And it'll be like in an interstitial pattern. If you see that, you want to think about a hantavirus. And unfortunately, at least from the research I did, there is really no treatment for hantavirus, right? If they talk about a person that, again, service member, maybe again, went deployed in Hawaii, maybe lives at an army base in Hawaii or whatever, right? And then they tell you that this person, you know, kind of had like fevers, myalgias, and usually like it's in the calf region, right? And they tell you that, oh, this person has been jaundiced, and this person has like conjunctival injection. Whenever you see that, again, and if you see like that Hawaii exposure, or again, they were deployed in the military, and maybe they were in the Navy or something, so they did a lot of like water-related work. and you see like conjunctival injection, you absolutely want to think about leptospirosis, right? You want to think about leptospirosis, right? Again, and remember leptospire interrogans, right? You know, it's a spirochete, right? So again, that's something you want to keep in mind. And the thing is, there's a particularly bad form of leptospirosis that's called a Weill disease, right? Weill disease, where essentially the leptospira will essentially like touch those people's kidneys and livers, right? And these people have like really bad anemia. They'll have like really bad jaundice. Their creatinine will be like super, super high. They'll have like poor urine production. Terrible, terrible place, terrible place to be. This is one of those things, again, you want to keep in mind. Another classic thing you may see on your test, right? So what if they give you a question about a patient? They tell you again, this patient was deployed, you know, like maybe like a hostile nation or something like that. And then they tell you that this patient for the past 3 days has been having like a lot of like a hemoptysis. And they tell you that on imaging, you see a widened mediastinum on imaging. And they may even show you like a black necrotic ulcer on the neck. If you see that, I would really hope you're thinking about anthrax under those circumstances, right? Remember, anthrax, right, is one of those things that has like, it has like a weird capsule that's made of polyglutamate, right? Bacillus anthracis, right? And there's actually a vaccine for it, believe it or not. But I mean, it's not something that's probably available to the public. It's more so for the military, right? Or people that go on these special missions, right? So remember, there's cutaneous anthrax. They'll have like the black eschar, right? And then there's also pulmonary anthrax. That one is terrible, terrible, terrible. That's like super bad, right? That's the thing where the people get like the hemorrhagic mediastinitis. So remember, a widened mediastinum on imaging on MBM exams does not just mean aortic dissection. It could also mean anthrax, okay? That could be like the anthrax causing the hemorrhagic mediastinitis. So again, all things you definitely want to keep in mind for exams. And then, before you go to a foreign country, right, like especially like a place, let's say you're going to like an African country, or you're going to an Asian country, or you're going to like India or something, again, for like some kind of a foreign mission or something, right? Or they tell you that before you go, let me maybe talk about before you go first, right? Like you want chemoprophylaxis, right? Like against malaria, right? And you know, typically you want to pick one of these drugs on your test. Like mefloquine is one you can use. Chloroquine is another one you can use. Although chloroquine, there's a lot of resistance, right? So it's probably not going to be the right answer in your test. It's going to be more along the lines of like mefloquine, doxycycline, primaquine, right? Although primaquine has not yet found prime time as like primary prophylaxis. I suspect it will very soon if you kind of read the literature on that. But primaquine is the one that we used to treat like the Vivax and Ovali, those ones that, those hypnozoids that can kind of stay in the liver for a long time, right? And then another classic one you may see on the test is the combination of atovaquone and proguanil, right? So A-T-O-V-A-Q-U-O-N-E, atovaquone, proguanil is P-R-O-G-U-A-N-I-L. Okay, so remember malaria, right? Again, it's caused by the Plasmodium species, right? So like Vivax or Ovali. So again, these are problems that can actually happen in a person that is coming back, a person that is just coming back from again being deployed, right? Because again, remember, sometimes Plasmodium species can lay very dormant in a person, right? They can lay dormant in a person. So if you see a person that goes to one of these countries and then returns, right? And then, you know, begins to have like some weird symptoms, again, begin to think about malaria, right? And what are these weird symptoms, right? These people have like recurring fevers, right? And they'll have like very severe chills. They'll have like nausea. They'll have like all this joint pain. They can have splenomegaly, right? Because remember, malaria loves to go after like red blood cells, and your spleen stores a ton of red blood cells. They'll have like anemia, right? And the thing is, the patient's fever is not going to be constant, right? They'll be asymptomatic between fevers, right? And the thing is, you may ask, okay, why is that? Why does that happen? The thing is, when the Plasmodium species infects red blood cells, right? Whenever they infect red blood cells and they are now like exploding the red blood cells to like go and infect new ones, like the merozoites, right? That's the time when those people tend to have the fevers, right? And the thing is, you want to know the kind of malaria, Plasmodium species, that goes with a kind of fever, right? So if they tell you that this person has tertian fevers, so fevers every 48 hours, you want to think about P. vivax and P. ovale, right? And that also should help you remember that P. vivax and P. ovale, those are the ones that tend to have that hypnozoid form, right? That stays dormant in the liver that you treat with primaquine, right? And then P. malariae, right? So those are tertian fevers. Plasmodium malariae causes quartan fevers every 72 hours, right? Quartan fevers every 72 hours, right? So essentially, right, that's the association we want to know there. And then the worst one, P. falciparum. The thing is, it causes fevers at like odd intervals, right? So you can put it into the tertian or the quadrant pool if you really want to do your research on that. So again, the reason these people tend to get into trouble is, again, these Plasmodium species, they lyse those red blood cells, right, to release the merozoites, right? So as you're lysing red blood cells, you're almost giving that person like a hemolytic anemia, right? Hemolytic anemia, right? And the thing is, sometimes people that have malaria, especially from P. falciparum is terrible. It can cause like cerebral malaria, all that badness, right? But the thing is, P. falciparum, sometimes they can even give you a question about a person that is a returning service member, and they tell you this person has like dark urine, right? If you see dark urine in a returning service member, you want to think about this thing called black water fever. Black water fever, it's associated with Plasmodium falciparum, right? And the thing is, P. falciparum, you actually need to treat it. If you don't treat it, I don't know, the person is probably going to die, right? Because remember, P. falciparum, it has the longest name of all the malaria species. So that should help you remember that it has the worst things that it can do, right? It can cause the bugs can congest the capillaries in the brain and cause cerebral malaria. That's usually pretty fatal, right? Or they can have like pulmonary edema because it basically makes your capillaries leaky from congestion, right? And then they can even have like renal failure, right? So if you see a person that's having like super bad symptoms after going to, again, one of these countries, like an African country or an Asian country, or coming back from India or something like that, you absolutely want to think about Plasmodium species. And remember, it's carried by the Anopheles mosquito, right? It's carried by the Anopheles mosquito. Now, what if they give you a question on your test about a patient and they tell you that, oh, this patient, again, just returned from being deployed, right? Returned from being deployed. And they tell you that, oh, this patient has been, this patient was exposed to, this patient was exposed to, you know, like a lot of like animals or like animal products or like unpasteurized milk, for example, right? And like when the person was deployed, they will just tell you that the person was exposed to a lot of animals like cattle and stuff, right? And then they tell you that this person has been having like, this person has like profuse sweating all the time, profuse sweating, joint muscle pain, right? And they tell you that this person has like ondulant fevers, right? So like picket fence fevers, they come, they go, they come, they go, they come, they go, right? If you see that, you want to think about brucellosis, okay? You want to think about brucellosis, right? And again, the way you get it is from being exposed to animals, especially like contaminated animal products like unpasteurized milk, right? Like unpasteurized milk. And one thing that people tend to confuse this stuff with, like brucellosis with, they tend to confuse it with Q fever, which is caused by Coxiella bonedii. I'll talk about that separately. But one key critical thing is that Coxiella presents as pneumonia, okay? Q fever presents as pneumonia on MBMEs, not Brucella, okay? Not Brucella, okay? So again, Brucella, again, they'll have the ondulant fevers and chills, right? They'll have like headaches and all that stuff, but look out for the term profuse sweating. It's very high yield. They tend to have profuse sweating. And the thing is, you don't require a ton of Brucella to get into trouble. It's a very, very low dose that you require, right? And again, you're exposed to animals or you're exposed to animal products that are contaminated, right? Like unpasteurized dairy products, right? And the thing is, usually it tends to keep coming back. Even if you treat it, it tends to keep coming back, coming back, coming back. So this can be something that they can give you about a person that returned from the force like years ago, right? And they're still having all these weird non-specific symptoms. If you see that, especially something that is happening years later, you absolutely, absolutely, absolutely want to think about Brucella under those circumstances. I know some of you may be saying this is almost like a micro review, but I promise you, this stuff I'm talking about is super, super high yield. Because think about it, right? Servicemen, by definition, for the most part, I mean, I know there's like army bases and everything in the US, right? But if you look at the USMLE's wording, right, they talk about like returning servicemen and women, right? So they're probably talking about people that went to foreign countries. And what's the, like the big infectious disease thing you get from a foreign country, right? It's going to be a zoonotic infection, right? So the thing is, again, these things, I promise you, you may say, Divine, who really cares about this? I promise you, when you're taking your step one or step two CK exam or step three, you will know exactly why you're listening to this podcast. I mean, they literally tell you. This is like no secret. They literally tell you. So if you know what's good for you, make sure you listen to the USMLE Military Podcast Part 1 and then listen to this podcast Part 2, which if you've gotten to this point, you're probably listening to it already, right? So again, super, super important. And the way you treat Brucella, right, you treat it with like doxycycline and rifampin, right? If you keep getting like recurrences, you can go ahead and give those people aminoglycosides like streptomycin or stuff like that. And then if they give you a question about a patient that, you know, again, maybe has like bloody diarrhea, like again, like a military person, you know, maybe the person is actually even still being deployed, and this person has like bloody diarrhea, right, and all that stuff, and maybe they have like a symmetric ascending paralysis or like reactive arthritis, right, you know, like those, one of those HLA-B27 positive seronegative spondyloarthropathies. You want to think about Campylobacter jejuni. It's actually one of the most common causes of bloody diarrhea in the military, right? So it's just something you want to watch out for. Some of these things, some of these statistics, I kind of got them from reading like the military, like literature, like military papers and stuff. They're actually kind of fascinating if you actually spend some time just kind of digging through them, right? And again, they may tell you that, oh, this person was deployed and, you know, was working with like a military dog or was exposed to a lot of dogs or cats or pigs, stuff like that. If you see that, you definitely want to think about a C. jejuni under those circumstances. And then I was kind of talking about like Q fever, right, with Coxiella, right? Again, people tend to mix this up with Brucella, right? So don't confuse Q fever with Brucella, okay? Don't confuse Q fever with Brucella, right? So the thing is, Q fever, right, Coxiella bonaria, is actually not carried by an arthropod, unlike many of these other zoonotic infections, right? And the thing is, for the most part, it's something you get from inhalation, right? Like, you know, when you, especially if they talk about like some involvement, like in a barn where animals were being born, right? Where like cattle were being born or sheep were being born, right? When the person was deployed, and then they tell you that, oh, this patient has like headache, cough, like flu-like symptoms, has like pneumonia. Again, remember, pneumonia, very, very high yield. Pneumonia, very, very high yield, right? If you see those things, and the person may even have like chest pain, right? Because it can cause like a culture negative endocarditis. If you see those kinds of things, you absolutely want to think about Q fever under those circumstances, okay? You want to think about Q fever under those circumstances. Now, another common military like infection is like leishmaniasis, right? Leishmaniasis is something you want to look out for, right? So the classic presentation will just be a person, again, that was deployed or just returning from deployment in like one of these like tropical countries, right? So like Mexico or like a South American country, or a person coming from the Middle East, that's a high yield one to know, or a person that maybe went to like North Africa or East Africa, right? If they tell you that, oh, this person is having like these hyperpigmented skin lesions, and then the person is having like hepatosplenomegaly, has like a really nasty anemia, right? And has like all these like fevers, like losing weight, and they have like pancytopenia, like they have like low red blood cells, low platelets, low white blood cell count. And again, if you see all that, but look for the dermatologic finding, the dark skin lesions, right? If you see that, you absolutely want to think about leishmaniasis, especially visceral leishmaniasis. That's the one that's carried by Leishmania donovani, right? Leishmania donovani. You actually do have to treat it. You can treat it with like amphotericin B or like a sodium stibogluconate, right? So amphotericin B or sodium stibogluconate. If you don't treat it, it is fatal. And don't forget that leishmania is actually carried by sandflies. And really, the way you make the diagnosis is you know, you can do like a tissue biopsy, right? And you can look at the amastigotes under the microscope, okay? So visceral leishmaniasis is probably the one you'll see on a test. But, you know, they can also have like, you know, like cutaneous leishmaniasis and all that stuff, right? So leishmania, bad, right? And then what if they give you a question about a patient, you know, again, returning service member, and they tell you that this person has like fevers, has like headache, has like myalgias, and then they tell you that this person has like a mild nuchal rigidity, you get a lumbar puncture, and, you know, the opening pressure is not that high, the white blood cell count is not that high, but it's predominantly lymphocytes, right? And the protein is not that high, the glucose is not that low, right? If you see that, you want to think about the West Nile virus, right? Remember, what the West Nile virus tends to torch the anterior horn, right? Of the, basically the ventral horn of the spinal cord, right? And again, it's supportive care doing to do anything special for those folks, right? And then, don't forget Chagas disease, again, returning service member, right? Returning service member, and then they tell you that, oh, this returning service member has like trouble swallowing, right? You want to think about achalasia, right? Or the person is having like chronic constipation, right? You want to think about you want to think about Hirschsprung disease, remember Chagas can actually cause Hirschsprung disease. Or they may tell you that, oh, the person has been having like shortness of breath, has an S3 heart sound and all that stuff. Again, returning service member, if you see any of these things, you absolutely want to think about Chagas disease. Remember, Chagas disease is transmitted by the Redovid bug, right? The Redovid bug. I think it's spelled as R-E-D-U-V-I-D, right? The Redovid bug. Again, it tends to cause big problems, right? And one very specific finding on MBME exams is that essentially these people may have like periorbital edema, right? Especially like if they tell you that, oh, the bite of the fly of the bug, right, looks is like near the eye, the person will have periorbital edema. If you see a person with like a unilateral periorbital edema and has all these other symptoms I'm talking about, think about Chagas disease on an MBME exam, right? It causes big problems, right? It can cause big esophagus, it can cause achalasia, it can cause a big heart, it can cause dilated cardiomyopathy, it can cause a big colon from Hirschsprung's disease, right? So that's something you want to keep in mind. And you know, you want to treat it with like benznidazole. You can also use this drug known as nifurdimox. You can use nifurdimox to treat the Chagas disease. And then some other quick things I guess I want to discuss here, although I'm kind of nearing the end of this, but if they give you a question about a patient, right, and they tell you that, oh, this patient, you know, again, a returning service member, and let's say this patient consumed like, you know, like worked with a lot of pets or turtles when he was deployed, or ate a lot of eggs, a lot of poultry. And then they tell you that, oh, this patient has like bloody diarrhea, right? Like really bad bloody diarrhea. And they tell you that, you know, they have like a elevated white blood cell count, and you see it's predominantly neutrophils. If you see that, then, you know, one thing you want to begin to consider is like Salmonella, right? Like Salmonella enteritidis, right? Sometimes instead of putting Salmonella enteritidis as an answer, they may put like non-typhoidal Salmonella species. If you see that, you want to think about non-typhoidal Salmonella. Unfortunately, this is one of those things you don't treat. If you treat it, I wish you all the best, right? But you basically don't want to, if you treat it, like, you'll essentially make the person get into trouble for much longer, right? For much longer. But please don't confuse Salmonella enteritidis, like the non-typhoidal Salmonella species, with Salmonella typhi. Salmonella typhi is the thing that causes like those raw spots on the abdomen. I kind of talked about this already in my video. I mean, in my micro podcast / videos and all that stuff. Right, and for the most part, if a person has like typhoid fever from Salmonella typhi, you know, you give them ceftriaxone. Remember, ceftriaxone is a third generation cephalosporin, or you can give them a fluoroquinolone, right? So something like ciprofloxacin, levofloxacin, gadifloxacin, or moxifloxacin, right? So those are all things you can use. And for the most part, they can even give you a question about a returning service member that has been having like a lot of like right upper quadrant pain. Remember, years later down the line, after a person has Salmonella typhi, believe it or not, they can actually have like cholecystitis, right? Because the bug can actually stay like a person can be like a chronic carrier, and the bug can essentially set up shop in the person's gallbladder, right? You can set up shop in the person's gallbladder. So, you know, that's something, again, you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. And then don't forget TB, right? TB is, again, something you can see in a returning service member, right? The person, for the most part, will have, like, again, like, you know, like a long-term cough, like a chronic cough. They have, like, a smidge of hemoptysis, will have chest pain, weight loss, fever, night sweats. You know, the classic symptoms, right? And obviously, if they give you a chest x-ray and you see, like, a right upper lobe infiltrate, like a cavitary lesion, that's TB, right? If a person has active TB, remember, you give them the right regimen, right? So you give them rifampin, isoniazid, pyrazinamide, and ethambutol, right? You do that for 2 months, and then you drop two of the drugs, and then you just continue with rifampin and isoniazid for the remaining 4 months, right? That's 6 months of therapy. And don't forget your vitamin B6 with those folks, right? Don't forget your vitamin B6. Don't forget your vitamin B6. Do not forget your vitamin B6. That's very important, right? And then don't forget, right, that before you give a patient primaquine, right? So again, they can make this a very nice, nifty MBME question. Before you give a patient primaquine for, you know, treating like P-Vivax or P-O-Vali or whatever of that crap, right? One thing you probably don't want to forget is go ahead and check those people for G6PD deficiency, right? Especially a guy, right? Because G6PD deficiency is X-linked recessive inheritance. So it's going to be in a guy on a test, right? It's not going to be in a woman. And if they give you a question about a patient that, you know, is going to a place that has a very high incidence of leptospirosis, and they're asking what drug can be given as prophylaxis before the patient, before the service member is deployed, you want to think about giving those people doxycycline. Okay, you want to think about giving those people doxycycline. Again, that's important. That's high yield to know. And then, And then what if they give you a question about a returning service member? They tell you that this person has been having like very, very high fevers, has like this rash all over the body, right? And then they tell you that, oh, this person has like prominent lymphadenopathy. And this person, like, they tell you that this person's myalgias are very severe, like very severe, very severe, like the bone breaking fevers. If you see that, you definitely want to think about, and this person has like some sign of bleeding. So look out for that. Look out for some sign of bleeding, right? So especially like there's this thing called the positive tourniquet test that's associated with a dengue, right? You know, if they tell you that, you know, like you apply a tourniquet, you leave it on for like 5 minutes and you notice like petechiae below the cuff of the tourniquet, or they tell you that the person has like FOBT positive stools, or they have like epistaxis, they have petechiae on the skin. Again, you definitely want to think about a dengue under those circumstances. And again, these people tend to have like just profound, profound. Again, you'll be a person that was likely deployed in a South American country, right? And again, they'll have high fevers, really bad chills, really bad myalgias. And they may tell you that, oh, the person has hematuria, has epistaxis as they're blowing their nose. Or they may tell you that they have like gingival bleeding. Like as we were brushing their teeth, you saw a lot of, they kind of like started bleeding, right? And usually they have like thrombocytopenia. So they have like very low platelets. And they also tend to have like LFT abnormalities, right? So their AST, ALT will be elevated on a test, especially the ALT, right? And again, the reason that they have all this bleeding is that the bulk causes like increased capillary permeability, right? So they begin to essentially leak blood. Okay, and remember, this is carried by the Aedes mosquito, right? AEDES, the Aedes mosquito. Again, that's why it's called dengue hemorrhagic fever. Sometimes knowing the full name of something is actually pretty helpful on MBM exams, right? So dengue hemorrhagic fever, dengue hemorrhagic fever, right? And the thing is, again, you don't want to confuse this with chikungunya, right? That's something that people tend to confuse a lot on exams. Dengue causes bleeding, causes hemorrhage, right? That's why it's called dengue hemorrhagic fever. But chikungunya actually does not cause any kind of hemorrhage, okay? Chikungunya is literally identical to a dengue on MBM exams, with a very notable exception that it does not cause any kind of hemorrhage, okay? It does not cause any kind of hemorrhage. And then, I mean, don't confuse this with Zika, right? Zika, again, you know, it'll be like, Zika is probably going to be in a woman on a test, right? Because, you know, pregnancy, you know, the works, right? So Zika, you know, they might have like this viral prodrome. So it may be like a returning service woman, right? And they'll tell you that, you know, she delivers a baby that has like microcephaly and like intracranial calcifications. If you see that, you want to think about Zika under those circumstances. And yellow fever, I mean, yellow fever is also something that maybe it may be confused with. But remember, yes, yellow fever affects the liver just like a dengue, right? But the thing is, people with yellow fever, they're going to have jaundice, right? They're going to have like scleralicters, they're going to have hepatomegaly on a test. Those are not things you'd necessarily find in dengue, in a dengue hemorrhagic fever. For the most part, you just rehydrate these patients, give supportive care, and, you know, all the best from there, pretty much, right? So so I think that's all I'm going to go ahead and say today. Again, this podcast, I know you may be like, this podcast sounds kind of weird. I promise you, it's very high yield to know. Very, very high yield to know. Again, this is no secret. Literally, this is straight from the USMLE. They literally put it in their content outline. So please make sure you take detailed notes on this, right? I promise you, it'll help you out on your test. And as I do at the end of every podcast, again, I offer one-on-one tutoring for many things, right? Step one, 2CK, 2CS, step three, preclinical med school exams, third-year clerkship shelf exams. And then I offer booster courses. It's like 20 hours for step one, 2CK, and step three. Again, very rapid fire with very high yield. We review the must knows, the very, very high yields for those exams. Again, people that have done this booster course with me, they found it to be extremely helpful. And then I'm also offering like a 30-hour pharmacology course for the USMLE step one. It's 30 hours. And I'll review all the pharmacology in an integrated format. So I'll integrate it with physiology, with pathology across multiple systems. And by the time you're done with the course, you will have zero pharm problems going into the USMLE step one exam. Again, this is something I've done for a long time. I'm very good at integrating things, thankfully, across our multiple disciplines, right? So if that's something you're interested in, reach out to me. And then, you know, if you also need like just one-on-one tutoring, like for your dedicated period or something, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for all these USMLE exams. And then even if you're an IMG, I've worked with tons of IMGs, I've worked with tons of DO students, I've worked with tons of USMD students, right? So again, if you fall into any of those categories, reach out to me. And then if you're a med student applying to residency, so like an ERAS application, or a college student applying to med school, so like an AMCAS app, again, I do like consulting on those, like, you know, rec letters, editing personal statements, editing applications, doing mock interviews. Again, I've been on an admissions committee for like a year. And again, I've worked with a ton of people that were going into a ton of different specialties, right? And the vast majority of people I've worked with have all matched at their first choice. And the thing is, if you have a tricky application, again, like I say, low scores, I graduated 10 years ago, I don't have research, blah, 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 blah. The thing is, I can almost always find a way to present your best foot forward in an application, right? Trust me, I've done this. There are people I've worked with that graduated 7 years ago, and they matched with this current match, right? So again, if that's something you're interested in, reach out to me. And then if you're a medicine resident and need tutoring for any of the like the board exams or the intern exam, or if you're a peds resident, again, board exams, intern exam, I tutor for all those things. And then if you have a buddy that needs tutoring for any of the pre-med subjects or any of the MCAT subjects, I do also offer tutoring for that. So please feel free to reach out to me either through the website divineinterventionpodcasts with an s at the end.com. Or you can send me an email at divineinterventionpodcasts@gmail.com. And please subscribe to the YouTube channel. It's called Divine Intervention USMLE Podcasts and Videos. Subscribe to the podcast. I have it on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, and on Google Play. In the interim, like the first 80 podcasts or thereabouts, you can find them for sure. You may not be able to find them on those podcast apps, but you can find them for sure on the website. All the podcasts are always going to be on the website. Again, divineinterventionpodcast.com. And then I guess my life lesson for today is the importance of taking responsibility. The importance of taking responsibility. So the thing is, you know, it's kind of important to take responsibility because I've noticed there's this trend with our current generation about always blaming someone else for their problems, right? You just always seem to find a way to like put the blame on someone. Like the blame is never to them. Like, oh, the financial crisis. Oh, it's because of this person. Or, oh, this. I didn't do so well on my exam. It's because of this person. Or it's because of this circumstance. You know, for a change, how about you sit up and take responsibility? Because the thing is, if you decide to be responsible for your life and say, you know what, the course of my future, right, depends on what I do today, it will make you proactive, right? It will make you proactive. You need to take responsibility for your future, right? And the thing is, this is not just like for example, you're like, I have this goal. I want to become a dermatologist. And, you know, you're not at a super well-ranked school, right? If you take responsibility for your life from the very beginning, right, then you will very likely match, right? A person that has that goal from the very beginning, you know, says, okay, you know what? Even if I'm at this, like, you know, not very well-ranked school, I will, you know, plan to do a ways. I will study really well in my first years of med school so I can do well on the USMLEs and all that stuff, right? Those are all things you can do. You can take steps proactively to make a good future for yourself. So you don't have to like sit down, start blaming someone in the future, right? So again, yes, sometimes are people to blame for problems. Like, can you really blame other people on some problems you're going through? Yes, right? But the thing is, blaming another person, like, is not going to solve anything for you, right? That time you spent blaming, you could have used it to do something proactive, right? So again, take responsibility for your life, even for your financial future, right? For some of you that are listening to this, you're like 30 years or you're rising 40 years, right? The thing is, have some savings, right? Because you never know. You never know. Look at how many people have lost their jobs with this crisis, right? Like if you're living paycheck to paycheck, what are you going to do, right? Do you want to become homeless? No, right? So take responsibility for your future. It is very important. And again, even when you get married, you have kids, take responsibility for your financial future. Don't say, oh, I've become a physician, I'm earning, you know, good money, I will go and buy 10 houses or what. No. If you're buying those 10 houses for investment, that's a different conversation. But, you know, just be prudent with your future, right? Be prudent with your future. The goals you know you have for the future, long-term, short-term, everything, be proactive about them. Don't depend on someone to, because people can fail, right? Human beings can fail. Regardless of how trustworthy a human being is, a human being can fail you, right? So again, be proactive about your future. So thank you for listening. I really appreciate you guys are listening to this. God bless you. I'll see you in the next podcast. Thank you.